This programme has been funded by the Broadcast Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.
Welcome back, everyone, to Heritage and Heroes. It's Dr. Alison Lennon here again, and today we are coming from the Abbey CBS in Newry. Again, I have Liam Gormley with me, who will ask me a few questions between our visits to the classroom.
Has Newry an interesting history?
Newry and the surrounding landscape has actually got a very interesting history. Newry itself is one of the oldest towns in Ireland. For more than 5,000 years, the area has been the centre of human activity. We have evidence of Neolithic settlement, St. Patrick and Christianity, Viking and Norman invasions, William Might Wars, the Newry Canal, which was actually the first true canal in the British Isles, a bustling industrial port, the Great Famine emigration, the upheavals of the Home Rule crisis, partition and the Troubles. So it has had a long and varied history. There is strong evidence of continual human habitation in the area from early times. We know that during the Bronze Age, Newry had a sort of factory-type community, and they were actually producing very detailed jewellery for clothes, brooches, clasps, stuff like that. In fact, you could actually see some of these Newry clasps in the Ulster Museum. In more recent times, when the new bypass was being built, well, it's not so new now, but when the bypass was being built, they were doing a survey and they came across a number of standing stones in an area down the Omish Road. And unfortunately, these, like many other finds, such as the ancient cave at the top of the Dublin Road near Newry, have seemingly, they were noted down, somebody took, you know, notes that they were here, but then they were forgotten about. And it is, you know, it's estimated that as many as 130, I think it's 130, ancient sites were discovered at the top of the Camlock Road. And among them, as far as I know, were three Neolithic homesteads. One of the most fascinating monuments associated with Newry is Daines Cast. And, you know, not many people have actually heard of Daines Cast. Etched across the landscape of a lot of Ireland and Britain are lengths of banks of earth and ditches, with evocative names like Scott's Dyke, there's the Grim Ditch, the Black Wall, and Daines Cast. Archaeologists call these earthworks, linear earthworks is the name they go by. And Ireland and Britain provide us with the oldest and longest types of these monuments in Europe. If you go across the North Midlands and South Ulster, there are about a dozen of these earthworks, and they've actually been grouped together, and they're known as the Black Pig's Dyke. Now, of course, I love the fact that, as with any ancient Irish monuments, there's a legend attached to Black Pig's Dyke. It's said that it got a name, its name from a giant, mystical school teacher, who turned into a pig and crashed through the landscape to form the dyke. Others have claimed that the dyke was actually the Great Wall of Lydia, which was a sort of unified boundary separating Ulster from Southern Ireland. However, time and research has proved that this theory is probably very unlikely. Ultimately, only six linear earthworks have been excavated in Ireland, which means that sort of they remain kind of mysterious. We don't know all that much about them. Segments of these linear earthworks can be found in County Down and are known as Daines Cast. And the best preserved section is alongside the Newry River, the Newry Canal at Scarvaux. The earthworks in Ulster can be dated to about the last 2 centuries BC. It's a very ancient archaeological monument.
Is there any particular monument in the area around Newry that you would particularly recommend to our listeners?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, Liam, because I actually am very fond of Narrowwater Castle, both as a visitor and as an archaeologist. This perfectly formed tower house is just outside Warren Point, and it's a place I love to visit with my family. It was a functioning castle for hundreds of years. It cost less than the price of an iPad, around £500 to build. It's perfectly formed, and you can go inside the castle and up the stairs through each floor, where you can examine the width of the walls and the various different windows throughout. And what's great about it is that it's open in summertime, and it's free in.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
We're in the Abbey School in Newry, an all-boys school, and we've come here today to talk about archaeology and history in this lovely area around Newry. The first thing I'm going to talk to you about is what I actually do. So what is archaeology, okay? Do any of you have any idea what an archaeologist does?
Old stuff.
Old stuff. What sort of old stuff?
Warriors and death and stuff like that. Because I've seen it on TV.
Okay, thank you.
My daddy watches it.
Okay.
They get diggers and open stuff.
Okay, very good. That's our first speaker. Thank you very much. Okay, now what do you think archaeology is?
Digging up dinosaur bones and like looking at the fossils.
Yeah, okay, all right, that's great, thank you. We're straying into paleontology there, but yes, it's the same idea. Anyone else know anything about archaeology? Well, archaeology, I suppose being an archaeologist is a bit like being a detective. Because what we're doing is we're like treasure hunters, and when we find things, we try and figure out what they mean. Archaeologists look at the things people from long ago have left behind. And then we use whatever we find to try and solve mysteries. Like, how did people build castles like Narrowwater when there was no cranes or no scaffolding? How could they cook food? They had no ovens. How did they make swords? These are the sort of questions we're interested in. How people lived, their houses, their clothes, their bones, even the rubbish. What does an archaeologist look for when they're out digging? What we look for, one of the things we look for, is something called artifacts. Could anyone take a guess at what an artifact is?
I think it's a small item from long ago.
A small item from long ago. Very good indeed. Okay. Artifact. Okay, think of that word, artifact. An artifact is anything made or used by humans. But the important thing about an artifact is that it's portable. You can carry it around. Okay, let's say in 100 years in the future, an archaeologist found this. And he would find this, because this is made out of plastic. It doesn't rot easily, so it would still be around in 100 years. And an archaeologist found this and dug it up. He tried to figure out what it would be used for. He'd examine it. And this would be considered an artifact. Now, there are a few artifacts that aren't portable. Like, have you found an ancient fire in the ground where there were signs it was used for cooking, but you couldn't actually lift it back to the museum. But it still would be considered an artifact. But most artifacts, are something physical you can pick up. Now, I'm going to show you a few artifacts, and I would like you to describe them for our listeners as I hand them round. And remember, the reason we're interested in artifacts is they give us clues as to what life was like a long time ago. So I'm going to come back to you, and I'm going to ask you guys to explain what it is I'm giving to you and to describe it for our audience. So, and don't worry, they'll get passed around. So I'm handing out some artifacts to the class, which students are going to explain for our listeners. What did I give you here? Now come on up here and talk to me.
An arrowhead.
An arrowhead. And it's made out of flint. And can I ask you something? We only ever find the arrowheads. We never find the wooden bit of it. Where do you think the wooden bit of the spear would go? Do you think wood would hang around for a long time?
No, it would rot.
It would rot. That's it, exactly. Good man. Can you come up here and describe what I've shown you, what I've given to you, what sort of an artifact?
It kind of looks like a dagger of some sort.
It does. Is it heavy?
It is.
It is heavy. And it's made out of a very hard rock, isn't it?
Yeah.
And again, this would have been a spear, but again, and a large spear, but again, there's no wood with it. Because we find the top of it, we find the arrowhead and the spearhead, but we don't find the wood. So what is this?
An arrowhead.
Again, it's an arrowhead, okay? And it's very sharp still, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can imagine this, couldn't you, on the end of an arrow. And if you got hit with this flying at you at a very fast speed, wouldn't be pleasant, would it?
No.
Be tough. Okay, what about anyone with a coin? Could they bring come up anyone with a coin? Yes. I've given out a number of coins, and I want you to sort of describe it to me.
It's got, like, quarters.
It's got quarters, yes, and it's got quite an intricate design, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And this was found here. This is actually a Viking coin that was found here, okay? Yeah. Now, the thing is that what happened was we did not have money in Ireland, a form of sort of coinage, until the Anglo-Normans arrived. We know that, there was exchange, we definitely used something, but it wasn't coinage. Originally, the sort of first things that would have been used were cows. Cows were used to buy things, and they were bought and sold, and they were a form of exchange. And so were things like bags of sort of crops, bags of wheat or whatever was the crop was. Archaeologists have found an awful lot of, a huge number, and we call them hoards because we find them all together, of cloak fasteners. But we found so many of them, we believe they must have been used as some sort of currency. And the other thing that we found was ring money, these sort of copper rings. And again, we found them in hoards, big piles of them. So we believe they must have been used as some sort of means of exchange. The first coins you sort of see in Ireland came with the Vikings. But the Vikings mainly used coins to trade with each other. They didn't sort of come into general currency. That only happened with the arrival of the Anglo-Normans at the end of the 12th century. And not long after that, mints started appearing around Ireland. Now, a mint is where you actually made the coins. And a number of them were granted a license here in Ireland. But we don't really have, we wouldn't have Roman coins as such in circulation. The Romans never got as far as Ireland. So Viking coinage would be sort of the earliest coinage we've come across. And does anyone know Carlingford?
Yeah,
you've been to Carlingford?
Yeah.
Well, one of the buildings in Carlingford is a mint. And it was granted a license in the middle of the 15th century to make coins. Now, we've never, ever found any coins that were made in this mint. So we don't know if it ever went into production, if they ever used the license. But we know it was granted a license. So they are artifacts that I've given out to you guys. You can hold them. You can walk around with them. You can take them back to the laboratory to examine them, okay? So they are artifacts. So remember that, because we're going to have a quiz about artifacts in a while. The main difference between artifacts and ecofacts is that ecofacts are environmental remains from something living that has hardly been changed by humans. So a gold lanula or necklace from the Bronze Age is an artifact, but bones are considered ecofacts, okay? Ecofacts involve a large class of natural materials to provide us with information about how humans lived. So things like pollen, the remains of plants, animal bones can tell us about the diets of ancient people. And charcoal, and we find a lot of charcoal from fires, they provide a sort of medium for radiocarbon dating, which is one way archaeologists use to date things, okay? And if we just look here at the difference between ecofacts and artifacts. Could someone come up and read for me what an ecofact is? Yes, come on up. Mm-hmm. If you just read this half here and just tell the our listeners what ecofacts are.
An ecofact is something natural from a living thing, plant or animal. Examples, bone, tooth and infants.
Could someone read? Yes, come on up. If you could tell us what an artifact is, because we've heard what an ecofact is.
An artifact is something made by man. Examples are pottery, tools, weapons, ceremonial remains, cave drawings, cloth and jewelry.
Very good, very good. Okay. So now we know artifacts and ecofacts. Do you know in Northern Ireland you have 1,901 listed monuments, historic monuments, that are classified as scheduled, which means they're protected. So you've got wonderful, like Dunluce Castle. Has anyone ever been to Dunluce Castle? Oh, it's a fabulous castle up the north of Ireland. So features. So we have artifacts, ecofacts, monument, and features. Now a feature is defined as a non-movable element of an archaeological site, okay? And there can be different types of features. You see this picture here? These are post holes. Now, when we have buildings made out of wood, the wood doesn't survive. But when they're in the earth for a long time, a post hole, which is part of a building, they stay in the soil. And when archaeologists uncover these, we can figure out how a building, the shape of the building, okay? Like, for instance, what shape is this building? Rectangle, okay? Features can also include machicolations, which I'll talk to you about, their defensive feature, windows or fireplaces, crenellations, doorways, whatever. So let's have a look at the features in this room. What would you think was a feature in this room? What would you call a feature in here?
A chimney.
A chimney, okay, very good. A chimney is a feature. What about in this classroom? Can you see any features?
The walls and the floor.
The walls, the floor, the doorways, the windows. They're all features. And archaeologists examine the feature to try and find out more about the building. And if we look at these post holes, again, for the audience, for the listeners, we're talking about post holes in the ground that tell us the shape of a building. What shape was this building? Out loud, guys.
Circle.
And this one was?
Rectangular.
Okay. So, has anyone ever been to Inch Abbey in County Down? You're so lucky, guys, because these monuments, I studied a lot of these monuments when I was doing my PhD, and I looked at the sort of buildings of Loudon Down, the monuments, medieval monuments, and there's just a wealth of beautiful archaeological monuments in your county. This is Inch Abbey, and features here, what do you think the features of this building are? Hands up and come up and tell me, what do you think?
Three of the windows are still intact.
Three of the windows, and they're lovely pointed arches, aren't they? And they would be features. This column, with the remains of this column, that would be a feature. And these holes here, which could have held wooden walkways, they'd be a feature. So there's numerous features in the building. So how do archaeologists know where to dig? Could anyone take a guess as how we figure out where to dig? Yes, if you want to come up and tell us how you think.
Like metal detector, maybe?
Metal detectors, that's one way, yeah, absolutely. In fact, a guy in Scotland a couple of years ago was out with his metal detector, and he found the biggest hoard of Viking gold, Viking treasure, just using his metal detector. Okay, come on up and tell me another way.
Someone could be renovating their garden or something and come across something like that.
Brilliant, brilliant. Members of the public uncover things, yes. In fact, in Ireland, an awful lot of our archaeological treasures were found by farmers out digging their land, like the Ardagh Chalice or the Cogglebeg Hoard. They were all found by farmers.
They'll look for vital resources nearby.
Excellent. Absolutely right. They look for things like water and wood nearby.
And they look for maybe where the ground might be slightly different, or there might be a difference
in the land. Yes, a dent or something in the ground, yes.
Or like a kind of a bog or something.
Yes, perfect. Thank you. That's brilliant. So let's just have a look quickly here. So one way is the question that I always get asked as an archaeologist is, why are you always digging? Like, why does archaeology involve so much digging? And I say, well, things get covered up. And they say, how? And I say, well, say you were walking home from school today and you dropped a pound coin. So the pound coin is lying on the grass. And someone comes along and walks and pushes it into the soil. And then what happens is there's rain and wind and litter and more things cover up the coin. And as people walk, it gets pushed down further and further. And that's why a lot of stuff was, we have to dig for it. Also, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people in the past would build pits, holes in the ground, to throw all the rubbish into. And that's another reason why we would have to uncover things. And as someone said, a brilliant point down here, people built near things that they really needed. They'd build near water, lakes for water. They'd build near forest for trees, and also because you get a lot of animals in the forest. So they would always sort of, they could use the water as well for fishing. You know, there was a lot of reasons. And the main transport, when you look back 5,000 or 6,000 years ago in Ireland, was by boat. We didn't have horses or anything for a long time. So we would go around the place, the coast, in a boat. As I said, farmers have uncovered a lot of things. And aerial photography is another big part of archaeology. I'm going to talk to you about that now. And someone else said metal detectors. Metal detectors is a good way, although you have to have a license to be using a metal detector in the south. I'm not sure about up here, but I know that because a lot of stuff has been uncovered, anything that's found in Ireland belongs to the state. Okay, now there's a Treasures Act. When that guy in Scotland found all that Viking treasure, they look at the value of it today and he gets paid. but you don't get to keep the stuff. It has to be given in. It has to be handed into the state. Aerial photography. Yes, come on up here. Anyone's a question, just come up and ask.
Would another way of finding stuff be if they find something nearby, they go digging around again, see if they find more?
That's exactly what happens. If someone found something in a field, say a bit of pottery from, I don't know, maybe the Mesolithic or the Neolithic period, or something, any sort of an artefact, they would then go and have a look at the site. So that's another good point. So aerial photography. Now, aerial photography is one of the best ways of understanding archaeological landscapes. I mean, I'm going to explain to you what I mean by this in a second by showing you a picture. Because it reveals and makes sense of features which are too faint or too large or too spread out for us to make sense of standing in a field looking at them. All they look at, like, is mounds of earth. We can't figure out what exactly they are. Now, aerial archaeology sounds, and it can be exciting, but it's not very glamorous. You're stuck in a wee small airplane. It's not roomy. It's usually a two-seater. And after a few hours sitting in this wee small airplane, looking down, you get achy, your body gets tired, and it can be freezing in the wintertime. But if you uncover something, if you see something from the air that you realize is an archaeological feature or site, something, it's the most exciting thing in the world. And most archaeologists like me, we could have been detectives, because what we want to do is to detect what something is. And it's very, very exciting work. And the way we see things on the ground from an aeroplane depends on whether or not the archaeological remains survive above ground or underground. Also, crop marks. Crop marks are a way of us telling, is there something under there, okay? And aerial archaeology is much more than just flying, taking photographs. Because once we've taken these photographs, we have to try and figure out what it is we found. So I'm going to show you something here. This is the Hill of Tara. Now, about 2 months ago, we took our daughter, who's 10, to the Hill of Tara. And to say she was disappointed doesn't even half explain it. She complained from the minute we got out of the car to the minute we got back into the car that it was rubbish. There was nothing to see. All there was a few hills, right? But Tara is far more impressive from the skies than it is when you actually visit it. Now, there is something about Tara. There's a great energy there. But it's not that impressive to look at. But Tara from the sky is incredible. I mean, we know that the Mound of the Hostages was constructed around 2500 BC. And it has been excavated. It's one of only two monuments that's been excavated at Tara. There are over 30 monuments at Tara. And when I say monument, this is a monument, okay, this earthen feature. There's over 30 monuments at Tara. And just for the audience, what I'm describing is a sort of central mound surrounded by two ditches, and there's two of them close together. But as well as having 30 visible monuments, we know that there's an awful lot of other monuments there that we can't actually see, okay? A huge temple, which measured about 170 metres and was made of over 300 wooden posts, we know that because of the post holes, was discovered very recently at Tara, okay? So again, aerial photography and other methods help us to uncover archaeological sites. So Northern Ireland from the air, this wonderful area from the air. Has anyone heard of Mount Sandal or been to Mount Sandal in Derry? Now, Mount Sandal is where the first people lived in Ireland. Okay, the very first people that lived in Ireland came to Mount Sandal. For instance, in Dundalk, where I'm from, we've got a place called Cuchulainn's Castle. Have you heard of Cuchulainn? And Cuchulainn's Castle in Dundalk is a very, very well-known monument. But actually, it's a strange story. Yes, there was an ancient mound constructed there a long, long time ago, okay, thousands of years. And then when the Normans arrived, they built a bigger mound on top of it, okay, and they built a marsh castle on top of that. So it was reused again by the Normans. Then the building that's actually there now, which is called Cuchulainn's Castle, actually belonged to a guy called the pirate Paddy Byrne, who was a well-known pirate around the seas of Dundalk later on in the 19th century, 18th, 19th century. So that site was reused again and again and again. So while Mount Sandal was originally the site of the first people to arrive in Ireland, it was reused again as an Iron Age fort. Okay. The Mesolithic site, which is the site of the first people to arrive in Ireland, was excavated in the 1970s, and it showed that there was at least seven structures there, okay? And mainly they consisted of these circular huts. You can see these huts here, and some of them look like an upside-down ice cream cone because they've been reconstructed. And they were only 3 metres in diameter, about 6 feet. So just think about that. They were very small spaces. But again, archaeologists have uncovered all this through looking at the evidence. That's what's so exciting about it. Excavating. Now, I've got another task for you to do in a minute, but I want to talk to you briefly about excavating. Does anyone know what excavating is?
Where they try to uncover old artefacts by digging up land and, you know, searching for clues and stuff like that.
Excellent. That's it. Good boy. There's various sort of stages to excavating. The first thing is a surface survey, where archaeologists just say we have looked at aerial photography and we found some sort of an earthwork. The first thing we do is we physically walk the field, walk the site, to see if there's anything visible, is there anything to be found, and is there any sort of features or something that might be the place where we need to start digging. Then we do a geophysical survey, which is trying to find things that you couldn't just see, okay? Structures, features, any other phenomenon below the ground. And we use things like ground penetrating radar, which lets us look at under the ground and see is there anything unusual there. Then we clear the site, which means we remove any rubbish or debris or vegetation from the surface so we can get ready for excavation. And sometimes we use a backhoe, it's a sort of shovel. Now, I have been in sites where we've actually used a digger to move the topsoil, but mainly we do it by hand. And then we make a grid of the site, okay? So you see how big the site's going to be, you set the grid, and then you dig trenches within the grid. And then finally, you record the site. So we as we make trenches in the grid, every sort of section has a number. So if we find a bit of pottery in one section, we'll know to dig around those other sections near to see if we can find more pottery, okay? And we use various tools when we're excavating. For instance, does anyone know what this is or what it looks like? Yes, a sieve, okay? And we use this. We would put material, we would dig up, and you put your whatever sort of soil into this. And you shake it exactly as if you were using a sieve. And whatever remains is examined to see if it's an artifact, okay? And sieves come in all shapes and sizes. Some sieves are absolutely huge. You can pass that down for everyone to look at it. So just for the audience, the sieve is about, I don't know, maybe 12 inches wide in green. And it has fairly, it's would hold very, very small artifacts. We also use this. These are called finds bags. And everything we find has to be put into one of these. And it has to be dated and given a number and a description. And these are then sent back to the laboratory or to the museum to be checked upon. And finally, we have these, which are brushes, okay? And we use these brushes to brush away the soil from around any potential artifact. And as you can see, they come in all shapes and sizes. These are actually for small finds, but we can have them fairly big brushes. And again, these are all used as part of the excavation. And once we uncover something, the artifacts are taken to a lab to be cleaned, catalogued and conserved. And the archaeologist examines the artifact and tries to figure out exactly what it is we've uncovered and tries to date it, which is what we're going to look at next. And artifacts are then preserved. That means cleaning. Sometimes it means they need to be treated with chemicals. And then they're sent to the National Museum for you to have a look at. So how do archaeologists date things? Well, one method is called dendrochronology, okay, and that's the counting of tree rings. So could someone give these out to the class? And what I'm giving for the listeners, what I've given them out is I've given them out a picture of a section of wood, and we want them to count the tree rings to figure out how old the tree is. And while you're doing that, okay, I am going to talk to our listeners about dendrochronology, okay? Dendrochronology, or tree ring dating, is the method of scientific dating based on the analysis of tree ring patterns. This technique was invented and developed during the 20th century, originally by A.E. Douglas, the founder of the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research, and that's based in the University of Arizona. And this technique, this technique for dating artifacts, can give dates in exact calendar years for wooden remains. Simply stated, many trees in a temperate climate grow one ring for each year of the tree's life. For the entire period of a tree's life, a year-by-year record or ring pattern is formed that also reflects the climate conditions in which the tree grew. Adequate moisture and a long-grown season results in a wide ring, so a wide tree ring. A drought year, when there's no rain, it's very dry, may result in a very narrow tree ring. Trees from the same region will tend to develop the same patterns of width for a given period. So when you, if you cut them and had a look at the tree ring, you'd see they were very similar. These patterns can be compared and matched ring for ring with trees grown in the same geographical zone and under similar climatic conditions. So what happens then is these tree ring patterns from living trees can be followed back through time and chronologies can be built up. So, to put it simply, we can compare wood from old or ancient structures to our known chronologies, and we can match the ring patterns. This is a technique known as cross-dating, and determine precisely the age of the wood used by the ancient builder. Okay, so for our listeners, we're going to see how old this piece of wood is. Does anyone think it was 40 years old? Under 40 years old? You can say no, guys. No. So it's over 40 years old.
Yeah.
Anyone on between 40 and 45?
No.
Anyone between 45 and 50?
No.
Anyone between 50 and 55?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone 51?
No.
52?
Yeah.
53?
Yeah.
54?
No.
55?
Yeah.
Hands up who said 52. Well done, you've dated the tree ring.
Okay,
and for our listeners, we're giving everyone a ruler that got it right. Okay, guys. So now we're going to move on to Newry, okay? Newry, this lovely town that you're all from. Newry is important because of its position, because of its location. It's on the main route between Ulster and Leinster, and its position on the Clanry River on its way to Carlingford Lough is very important, and it also leads out to the Irish Sea. And St. Patrick brought Christianity to Ireland. You all know that, don't you? And during one of his many missions, he set up camp at a sandy stretch of the Clanry River, and he planted a yew tree as a symbol of the growing faith. And it is this story which gives Newry its name, Lubbochan Tra, the yew tree at the head of the Strand. A monastery grew up around this yew tree and was later replaced in 1144 by a Cistercian abbey. And when 1144 was where the town was established, the town grew up around this abbey. Mortimer MacLachlan, the High King of Ireland, granted a charter to the Cistercians in 1157. And the abbey, this abbey, the Cistercian abbey, gave the town a focus of somewhere to grow up around. This often happened with monasteries. You'd see a town spring up around them. And the abbey survived until the mid-16th century when, because of the Reformation, the monks' lands, almost 5,500 acres, passed to Nicholas Bagnall, whose name we're all familiar with, aren't we? Because of Bagnall's Castle, yeah? And he was a marshal in King Henry VIII's army. And at this stage, in the mid-16th century, there were 72 houses in Newry. So it was quite a big town for the time. We also had a visit from the Vikings in the 8th century, and Clevioel churches were attacked, which we're going to have a look at. And John de Courcy in 1177 built a number of mock castles in the area. And in 1315, Robert de Bruce captured Newry. Okay, so there was a lot of history in this town. Okay, yes, come on up and ask me.
That's where our school got its name from.
What?
The abbey.
Right. Oh, you got it from the Cistercian Abbey?
Yeah.
I didn't realise that. That's wonderful. Thank you for telling us that. See, it's great when I come out to schools like this because I learn new stuff as well. So Mourne Curly Gullion, this is the area we all live in, okay? And I'm going to talk to you today about suzerains, dolmens, and we might mention court terms as well. And I'm not going to get into it now, we're going to talk about them as we sort of come along to them. Could someone come up and describe this first picture for me? Yes, come on up and describe this first picture here and tell our listeners what this looks like. And this is Binder's Cove suzerain at Finnis. So what does it look like?
I think it looks like a really, like, cobblestone tunnel.
Cobblestone tunnel, okay. Yep, that's a good enough description for me. What about this one over here? Could I get someone from our listeners to come up and describe it for me? And this one up here is Ballykeel Dolmen. Could you describe that for me?
It's like three stones in a circle standing up, holding up one big stone.
Perfect description, thank you. And I won't ask anyone to describe this because this doesn't look like anything that it looked like at the time. But this was a court tomb and it would have had a roof over it and it was a burial chamber, okay? Now these are the remains of it now and all that's remaining now is a number of sort of standing stones. But when this was originally constructed, this would have been a very, very impressive chamber. A rath, R-A-T-H, was a type of Irish farm. But it was fortified. They're also known as leash or a ring fort, and they are the most common monument found in Ireland. There's over 30,000 sites. So there's one central area. So just to describe for our listeners, there's a circular area, and it's surrounded by a palisade or fence, okay? And there's huts within this circular area. And then there's a steep ditch, and then it comes back up into an earthen bank. And sometimes we would actually have not just one of these ditches and banks, but two or even three of them surrounding the settlement. Now, as archaeologists, every settlement we've uncovered, every rath, the circle is bare. Why do you think the circle is always bare? There's nothing left in the circle. Any clue? Why do you think we never find houses? We never find any remains?
Because they're made of wood.
Because they're made of wood. Thank you very much. And but we figure we have to sort of try and figure out what they would have been like. So we think there would have been one or two or more round thatched houses. And although fortified, they were also the homesteads of affluent early medieval farmers. Now let me ask you this, guys. Why would you need to defend your home?
I think people will be trying to attack your home for all your loot.
Right.
And maybe try to steal all your things.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe other people will be jealous of other people and try and steal their crops, maybe if they had a crop that they didn't want, or their animals and stuff like that. They might want to steal.
Very good.
Maybe if there was someone about to attack them, or they thought there was a threat of someone attacking them, they could defend their houses so that they couldn't take anything from them.
Good point, okay.
Someone trying to take, like, taxes or something from them.
Yeah, well, all right, that's another point.
I thought those things looked like the like settlements on Tara Hill or something.
Yeah, well, it's they have an earthen bank, so there is similarities with them. That's, so yeah, yeah.
It would prevent stealing of animals and of animals escaping.
Just wanted to protect their animals from, like, foxes and things.
Yeah, okay. All right. I love the way you all come up with different ideas. The most valuable thing belonging to these farmers was cattle. And this is what most of these defences were for. To stop people cattle raiding and stealing their cows, okay? So well done. Most of you are pointing in that direction. All right. So Lisnagaid Ford. Has anyone ever heard of this? Again, this isn't far from you guys. This is the Ford of the Hundred, okay? It's one of the larger Celtic raths, and it's 3 miles west of Banbridge, so it's up the top of County Down. And it's a circular earthwork. Now, you can't really see it because it's overgrown with trees. So for our listeners, there is a circle filled with trees. But this is actually a massive circular earthwork, and the three ditches separated by banks, and the banks are around six metres high. So think about 6 metres high. So you had the settlement in the middle, and then you went down 6 metres, and then back up again. 6 metres, and then back up again. Three times. We have found artefacts here from the Bronze Era, but little is known about the people who lived at this site. And it dates back more than 1,000 years, and archaeologists reckon it was constructed around 350 AD. And then near it, there were another 10 farmsteads. So this was some sort of a settlement. And the one at Lisnagrad, the main one, is 370 metres in diameter. Okay. So this, as I said, it wasn't just one rath on its own. There was a number of it in the vicinity. Then you also have Danes Cast. Okay, and I'm going to show you Danes Cast now in a second. And this was a long defensive bank. So again, it was an earthwork that was meant to keep something or someone out. And it's not round. What this is actually, and it's something to do with the Danes. It's called Danes Cast, but it's not actually anything to do with the Danes. It was constructed in the 4th century, and it's one of a series of Iron Age earthworks that run from south down to north Sligo. And it's known as the Danes Cast, and it's in Danes Cast. This sort of barrier, this earthen barrier, goes through counties Armagh and Down. It's in the Black Pigs Dyke, which I'm going to show you now, in County Monaghan, and the Warm Ditch in County Cavan. And they're not all joined together, it's discontinuous, but they were all built, we think, with the same purpose in mind. And there would have probably been a palisade or a wooden fence along the top of the banks. And they come along, you have this earthen bank, say in Monaghan, and then it would be interrupted by a natural obstacle like a lake or a bog or a mountain, like Lake Mucknow, and it was some sort of a defence. And what we think it was it was a territorial boundary, or a bank, an earthen bank, a boundary to stop cattle thieves. Okay, and again shows that the Iron Age was very unsettled in Ireland. And if I just show you a picture here of it, what I'm showing the audience is, or what I'm showing the boys here is a picture of Northern Ireland. And I'm showing them the line of the Black Pigs Dyke. And then you see up here at Dorsey and Fathom and Lisnagrad, and went right across from one sea to the next, crossing the whole of Northern Ireland, the whole of Ulster. And there's a word mentioned there, Éamon Macha. And that's Navan Fort. I'm going to talk to you about it next. So who's been to Navan Fort? I was there on Sunday with my family, and I was extremely impressed. What I was impressed, and this, what I always am impressed with monuments in Northern Ireland, is how well you look after your monuments. You know, you take a great pride in the various ancient, medieval, Christian monuments you have. And they're always very welcome, these interpretive centres. And it was wonderful now, the visitor centre in Éamon Macha. And so it's become, it was already a busy place by the late Bronze Age. There was a roundhouse and enclosures at Navan Fort. We have a site called the King's Stables, it's very well known, and a votive pool in Loch na Shead. And there was a hilltop fort known today, and you can actually see it as Hahi's Fort. So there was something there in the ancient times. But around 100 BC, the earliest structures at Navan Fort were replaced by this huge circular structure, a huge roundhouse about 40 metres in diameter, and it was built up from 275 wooden posts, and they had this huge central wooden post in the middle of this roundhouse, and it required a ramp at least 6 metres long to raise this huge post. Now, this wasn't built initially. When you saw this, you thought, oh, they must have all lived in here. But that wasn't what it was built for. It was never inhabited. Instead, when they built it, they filled it with earthen boulders. And dendrochronology, which we did, the dating of tree rings, dates the burning to about 95 BC. And it's a very mysterious story. It suggests that Navan Fort or Éamon Macha was not a defensive holding, but there was some deep and symbolic meaning to whoever built it. They built this structure. They had no cranes. They had no sort of equipment. They built it by hand. This huge, huge wooden structure, perfectly constructed. And then they filled it with rocks and soil, and then they burnt it down deliberately. It has some meaning that we've yet to understand. Now, a lot of our monuments were tied up with death and ritual. Death and ritual is a big part of our culture from ancient times, okay? So dolmen also means stone table because of this sort of big stone on top. And we have uncovered human remains at some of these dolmens. And we've also uncovered grave goods, where people would be buried with something that was important to them, a sword or a cloak or whatever, okay? So we're going to look at some dolmens in Northern Ireland. The date from about 4,000 years ago, 2,500 BC, and there's an awful lot of dolmens along the east coast of Ireland, so where we live. There are about 190 dolmens in Ireland, and they're called various names, from Crumlocks, Giant's Graves, Leabas, Diarmuid and Guarna Beds, and Stone Tables. And the massive stone slab on top, as I said, can weigh tons. In fact, if we look here at Garward Dolmen, okay, now Garward Dolmen is in the townland of Castle Welling. Does anyone know Castle Welling?
Yeah.
Have you been to Castle Welling? It's another fabulous spot. And this is a portal tomb or a dolmen, which is dated to about 2,500 years BC. And this huge capstone slipped from its original position and just crushed down onto the stones, okay? It's known as Pat Kearney's Big Stone because the caretaker of the monument who lived in the cottage beside it was called Pat Kearney. So people call it Pat Kearney's Big Stone. And it was excavated about 150 years ago, and there was a flint arrowhead found, like the arrowheads I passed around earlier. And it's about 44 metres long, and it weighs the capstone 50 tonnes. Okay, now listen to me, guys. 50 tons. Okay, so we're talking about what? About 10 elephants. Okay, now, how did they get the capstone up on top of the standing stones? And before you answer, I want to tell you that we don't know. Archaeologists don't know. So there's no right or wrong answer. So would anyone care to take a guess about how they got that capstone up on top of the tree standing stones? And remember, no cranes, no equipment like that at all. So how do you think?
I think ice from the Ice Age might have carried it over from somewhere else.
Okay, well, that's true. A lot of the stones in Northern Ireland were carried over from someone else. Very good, okay. And is there anything else you want to...
No, that's it.
That's grand. That's great. Okay, guys.
I think they could have left it up. They could have got a couple of hundred people maybe to lift it up and then put wood underneath it and keep doing that till it gets elevated.
Go on.
Yeah, like workhorses to pull it, like to pull the fly off.
Use some sort of animal to pull it up, okay?
People to push the stone up on top of it.
Yes, okay.
It might have been on a mound, and then they would have dug out places for the stones.
You are the first student in any school that I've been to that got that answer right. Do you know that? You are the first student ever to guess what I think it is. Thank you. Very well done. Come over to me. Very well done. What I believe happened is this. I believe that they got the standing stones up, which wouldn't have been as heavy, okay? And then they built a mound over the standing stones. So they dug loads and loads and loads of earth, and they built a hill over these standing stones. And then through some method, whether through someone mentioned animals, that they got the stone pulled and pushed up on top of the standing stones, and then they dug away all of the earth. That's what I think. Now, we don't know, but well done. Very well done, because that's not something students usually think of, okay? So that's Garward. And now we have, isn't this a class monument? This is Kilfagan. And it was standing on two stones, not three. And over the centuries, it has pushed the stones into the ground. It's 4,500 years old, 35-ton capstone, and I think it's the cutest dolmen I've ever seen. What do you think of it, guys? Isn't it cool? Imagine the weight of that capstone. Imagine pushing it into the ground. Okay, and then we have the best one, I think, in Ireland, Leganani Dolmen. Has anyone ever heard of Leganani Dolmen? I think it's a gorgeous, it's very unusual. It's a very unusual, it's a slender and delicate dolmen. And it's not far from Banbridge, and it's actually on the slopes of Slieve Croob. And its name comes from Annie's dolmen, Leagan Anya, okay? Oh, sorry, Anya's dolmen. And the capstone I love because the capstone is actually 3 metres long. So it's 9 feet long, the capstone. It's about 5,000 years old. So just think about that, guys. A monument that was built by people, by humans, 5,000 years ago. So that's our dolmens. So if we come back up now, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about Newry. So Bagnes Castle, we've all been there, yes? Have you been to the museum? So as we mentioned earlier, Sir Nicholas Bagnell, and he came from Staffordshire in England, so he actually moved over here and settled here, and he was granted the Cistercian Abbey at Newry, which this school is named after. So Colleviol Churches, who's been to Colleviol Churches? Yeah? So Colleviol Churches are really, really ancient churches, okay? You know, there's a lot of history about them. They're at the foot of Slieve Gullion. Who's been to Slieve Gullion? So, yeah, Slieve Gullion, wonderful, wonderful place. Well, these churches are at the foot of it. And they were founded at the 5th century by a saint called Monina. Now, my mum was actually named after Monina. And so it was a house of nuns for almost 1,000 years. It is famous because it was attacked by the Vikings in 1923. One of the reasons it was famous. They came to Carlingford and then came into Newry, into Colleviol Churches, and attacked them. And in 1146, people were killed by a great wind that caused damage all over the north. So it was some sort of a storm in 1146, and it caused a lot of damage, and it actually damaged Colleviol's old churches. Now, then it was also a convent of Augustinian nuns, which was dissolved in 1542. It's a very, very long, narrow church. If I can describe it for the listeners, it's probably looks very long, because it's not actually one church. It's two churches connected together. It's the West Church is the only surviving pre-Norman church in County Armagh, and there's a door in it that actually dates to the 10th century. Also, strangely enough, there was also a round tower here, but it was knocked down at some stage in the 18th century. It was actually blown down by a gale. And no one here has visited a souterrain, no? Loud, in County Loud, we have more souterrains than anywhere else in the country. Now, we actually, when I was young, my father, who was very interested in archaeology, used to take us around to see all the souterrains. And in those days, you could get into any souterrain. But a couple of them collapsed. It's not as easy to get into them now. But basically, it's an underground passage. And sometimes it leads to a chamber. If you look at this picture here, and for our listeners, what we're looking for is a straw roof dwelling, and just beside it, there is an underground passage that's lined with stones, and there's people in the underground passage. They were both a defensive feature, so they were there to protect the people in the house, and they were also a cellar. And most of them were built between 500 and 1200 AD. Now, the word souterrain is French. It means underground, okay? So it's a French word. In Irish, we use the word uive for a souterrain. And although they're all quite similar, there is a diversity of design, and different materials were used to build them. So how they were built was you'd excavate a large trench, and then you'd have different passageways and chambers that were lined by dry stone walls. And then you would have these sort of long carved stones, lintel, on top to form the roof. And then you'd grow soil over them so it would hide the exits and entrances. So you'd know how to get in and out, but people attacking you didn't know how to get in and out. So this is Binder's Cove souterrain, okay? Could anyone guess, like, why would they have built souterrains? To me, I think it's more to do with defence. What do you think?
I think they'd have used souterrains to, like, escape people.
Yes, to hide from people. Yes, yeah. Yes. They were less a form of attack, but they'd also incorporate little features. Like, they might have a wee sort of step or a wee sticking up stone as you came into the corridor. The family would know it was there, but attackers wouldn't, and they'd fall over the stone. So they did have these defensive features, okay? And local chieftains would often raid each other's territory. And they had these well-concealed entrances. Now, Binder's Cove is a fabulous souterrain. If we just say it again to our listeners, you have this long corridor. It's about long tunnel, about 30 metres long. It's 3 feet wide, and it's 1.5 metres tall. So you could stand up in it, okay? Because they were fairly, you know, smaller people could certainly have stood up in it. And as we said, it was used for both defence and as a larder to keep food to keep food fresh. Moira Castle, does anyone know Moira Castle? It's not far from here, and I love Moira Castle. It was built in the Moira Pass, which was the main pass between the Leinster and Ulster for a long time. In fact, in Dundalk we have Roach Castle that also guards the Moira Pass. But it was a little keep, little tower, and you see this feature here. This is like a stone sort of a stone feature that juts out from the top of the castle, and there's a hole in it. And when people would attack the castle, the people inside the house would throw stones down through this machicolation and hit the attackers on the head. And it was built around the beginning of the 17th century by Lord Mountjoy. And again, it was to protect the route between Leinster and Ulster. So Narrowwater Castle, okay? And it was built, Narrowwater Castle was built 16th century. And it cost £361 to build. So you could, I think the new Nintendo Switch is around £350. So for the price of a console today, you could have had your own castle in the 16th century. Has anyone visited the castle? Has anyone ever been out to Narrowwater Castle? Then you can come up and tell me a wee bit about it, what it's like. Okay. Has anyone ever actually been in the castle? Come up to me, anyone who's ever been. I want you to tell the audience what it's like. Go on ahead.
I was in a castle, and like it was surrounded by like broken down walls, and it was scary.
Okay.
I think it was really old. I think it was like St. John's one in Carlingford.
Oh, Carlingford. Okay. Yeah. It's been reconstructed at the minute. Yeah. They're doing some work to it.
Every year in Carlingford, like every couple of years, they put people down and sleep in some castle.
Right, okay, good man. So you thought the castle was a wee bit scary?
Yeah, very scary.
Okay, and you've been in Narrowwater. Could you describe for our listeners what it's like?
It's got some thin stairs on the way up to the different floors.
That's right.
And there's lots of windowsills next to them.
That's right. And did you notice how thick the walls were when you looked at the windows? Because the walls were about 3 metres thick, which is standard in a lot of these castles. A metre thick. And then tell me, were there a lot of light in the castle or was it dark?
There wasn't much light because only the windows would give you the light.
Yes, and they would narrow into a nope, a quite small window, didn't they? Yeah, did you like Narrowwater?
Yeah, it was lovely.
Yeah, it's a class castle. Yeah, thank you very much for coming up. This, your castle, which is only down the road, is one of the best preserved 16th century castles in Ireland. So there was a keep there in 1212. Hugh de Lacy, who built Green Castle and King John's Castle, he actually had built a construction there to prevent attacks on Newry, okay, through Carlingford Lock. The tower house that we have now and the barn, which is sort of the courtyard surrounding it, were built in the 1560s, and they belong to a family called the McGuinness family. Does anyone know the name McGuinness, or has the name McGuinness know? It's a well-known name around here. And then it was sold to the Hall family. And, you know, over the years, that castle was used for a family home, a salt works, and even as dog kennels in 1844. They're a typical example of tower houses that were built throughout Ireland from the 14th to the 17th century. It's normally rectangular in plan. There are three or more stories high. They have a number of chambers with stairs, closet and garderobes skillfully built into the walls, which are 1.5 metres or 5 feet thick in places. And they would sometimes have turrets. Okay, so it's quite standard, the design of Narrowwater Castle. Now, we're coming up to the end, and what I want to say to you all is that thank you for taking part, and thank you for being brave enough to come forward and tell us your ideas or what you think about things. Now, we're going to finish up now. I'm leaving treats, which is all for your teacher. You can give them to you later. And I want you to give yourselves a big clap. Well done, the Abbey School. Well done. Okay. That's us. Okay, guys, thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen and all our listeners, I hope you have enjoyed our third programme in our series, Heritage and Heroes.
So, we finished today at the Abbey CBS School here in Uri. It's a wonderful school, very, very modern. We had a wonderful time. We're very welcomed by the students and the teachers.
We really hope you, like the students, are learning a lot about the history of the various schools we visit and their surrounding landscape. We'll be back next week for our final programme. Bye-bye for now. Thanks for listening.
This programme has been funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.